Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Welcome to Hollywood and Levine. I am Ken Levine, your podcast host, broadcasting from a secret location deep within my house. Anyway, this is part two of my Zoom interview with writer Billy Van Zandt. Now, he has just written a terrific book about his adventures in the sitcom trenches called Get in the Car, Jane. If you missed part one, after you listen to this one, go back and check that one out. It's a very interesting ride that he and Jane have had in the world of television comedy. Well, this week he talks a lot about pilots, creating a show, show running, and all of the craziness that comes with that, and trying to maintain the quality of a series. So, part two, Billy Van Zandt, this week on Hollywood and Levine. You did the first year of Martin. Talk a little bit about Martin Lawrence.
We did. We got a phone call from John Bowman, who co-created it, and he wanted to hire us. And he said, "Do you know who Martin Lawrence is?" And I immediately said, "You mean the art galleries that are in all the malls?" And he said, "No, it's a comedian named Martin Lawrence. I had never heard of him." They sent us a tape. It was the funniest thing in the world. And we said yes right away. But they made us promise we wouldn't quit because we had just come off of Nurses. And I made them promise that I didn't have to pretend I was black when I wrote the scripts. I wasn't going to put in jargon and, you know, that I don't speak. And I didn't want to, it seemed patronizing or something. So I said, "You got a whole writing staff of black guys and ladies. And if something I write doesn't sound right, they'll fix it." And they said, "Okay." And that's what we did. Martin, unbelievably, was very much like Bob Newhart. One take, the audience in the bleachers was all that mattered. And he was brilliant. He just was brilliant. He was a pain in the neck sometimes.
In what way?
I remember the first meeting we had, he insisted that, he yelled at all of us. He said, "Why aren't the, stand up and let the brothers sit down. Let the brothers sit down." And there was like, "There aren't any black guys at this meeting. It's just us and you." "Well, then you better go get some." So we send to the writer's room and the writing staff comes down. They have nothing to do with this meeting whatsoever. And they sit around on the chairs and we're all standing behind them now. And Jane leans over to Martin and says, "You know, I'm the only girl here. Nobody seems to have a problem with that." And he just hated us a little bit more from that moment on. but we had a good time writing that show, I will say. And the thing with Martin that I thought was pretty interesting is he was so naturally funny. It reminded me what I thought that Jackie Gleason and Audrey Meadows must have been like, because I just blanked on her name. Jeez. The girl played Gina, Tisha Campbell. Geez. She basically had to let Martin improvise wherever he felt like it and then find him amusing, find him sexy, and get back into the script somehow, because we didn't stop the tape, you know, we just kept going. And she was brilliant at that, just really brilliant at that. But he was hilariously funny. But when he didn't like a script, oh, that was not pleasant.
How often was that?
Towards the end of the first season, I would say every week. He would show up with sunglasses on. That told us he didn't like the script for the read-through. If he had sunglasses and a hood on, we knew he really hated it. And then the third thing he would do is he would suck on lollipops while he was reading the script with the sunglasses and the hoodie on. And that meant, watch out, he's going to come and scream at us all in a minute. And so it was always an interesting day on The Martin Show.
But if week after week he hated the scripts, couldn't he convey to you just what it was that bothered him so that that wouldn't repeat week after week? Or it just was a different thing each week?
It was different every week. And after he would come into the writer's room and yell at us, he would drag a couple of his friends who were on the staff out into the hall, and we could hear him threatening to kill them if he didn't make the scripts funnier.
Yeah. Ted Danson never did that to us. Shelley Long never threatened us. Well, you've worked with some interesting stand-up comedians. You also did Bless This House with Andrew Dice Clay. What was the Dice Man like?
I really enjoyed him, but he was out there. He's out there. He had come to our show from a six episode Ralph Macchio show that we Bruce Rasmussen had created and we worked on. And Andrew was going through a dry period where, you know, his stand-up act had offended quite a bit of women.
So everyone.
He dropped the word dice out of his name, and he was Andrew Clay. And he did the Ralph Macchio show, and he was so hilariously funny that the Ralph Macchio show went away, and Andrew had his own deal to do a new show. Entered Bless This House. Bruce Helford created it, and then he created Drew Carey's show at the same time. Couldn't run them both. Asked Jane and me to run Bless His House. Andrew was always funny. Never knew his lines, which irritated his co-star Kathy Moriarty a lot. She said, "I know how we can get him to learn his lines." I said, "What? We refuse to pay him unless he can prove he knows his lines." I said, "Well, I don't think
good
it's
luck
gonna
with
work
that." Yet. Yeah.
Yeah. And every Thursday was camera blocking day, and he was supposed to have his lines memorized by then. But instead, he would find some weird thing would be going on the set, and we'd be called down. He keeps swatting flies. And we don't know why, but he keeps swatting flies. And the next week would be, he wants to speak in a Spanish accent. And it's like, what's going on here? And then we realized it gave him another day to learn his lines because he could get away with this stuff. Then we had Elaine Stritch on the show, which is one of my favorite weeks of any week we've ever had.
Really? Because we had her on Cheers and fired her.
She was so difficult.
We fired her.
I loved it because the product she was giving us was great. But she was all over the place. She screamed, get that couch out of my dressing room. You think I'm here to entertain people? That kind of stuff. Our show was pretty good. We were great ratings. The reviews were good. And we got killed because I think somebody's wife didn't want him on the network anymore, or he must have refused to wear the postal uniform. He wanted to carry it on a hanger because he wanted to wear his leather. I did like the product of what he gave us, but it was a lot of work to go get there.
He too must be two people, the on Andrew Dice Clay guy and the other one.
Absolutely. The first, he had a party at his house at the opening of the show and with his wife and his kid. And it was just a sweet little family who happened to say vulgar things to make a living. But we had a good time with him, actually.
Okay, now I'm going to talk about a good experience you had with an actress, and that is Brooke Shields. You guys did a hastily conceived and put together pilot for Suddenly Susan.
We did. I had a great time with her, but we ended up firing us from the show.
But it really wasn't fair because you guys were brought in like at the last minute, given sort of an impossible task of casting and rewriting and putting this show together in like 2 weeks. It's
literally
like
2 weeks.
Like that's insane. It's just insane. The fact that you did it.
We did it. We proved something to ourselves, but I don't know what we ended up getting out of it.
Well, what you got was you got the show on the air.
We did. We were asked, there had been a one-camera show written by Clyde Phillips, who was a very good writer, but he'd only done 1 hour. And Brooke liked that show, and NBC wanted to turn it into a comedy, and he didn't really know how to write a comedy. So they brought us in, and we said, no, we can't. We can't. We're leaving. We got to play. We're doing Back East. We can't do this. And they said, well, will you just give notes to the president of the network? And it was like, well, I don't know the president of the network. I've never worked for NBC, but I don't really have a choice. Okay. So we went and we gave the notes. We walk into the meeting and there was what seems like 500 people in the room. And Warren Littlefield, the president, says, we want to thank Billy and Jane for taking over Suddenly Susan.
No one told you.
No one told us. No one asked us. And so we realized we're sort of stuck doing this because at the time, you know, how many networks were there? So we said yes, and we spent Friday, Saturday, and Sunday developing it, and had no idea what we were going to do. The original show had taken place in a test kitchen for like a Denny's restaurant, and we were turning it into a magazine where Brooke was going to be the editor for a romance novelist played by Elizabeth Ashley. And by the time we finished the script, we were dead. And we walk in, and suddenly they start giving us notes as if we've been writing this for 100 years. So we do the read-through. Everybody's killing at it. It's great. And then suddenly we start getting these notes. And there was one guy in particular. I don't see the character doing this. And I was like, who the hell are you? And what do you mean you didn't see the character? We created it yesterday. And but we ended up putting the show together, editing it, turning it in within 2 weeks. And then we heard it was picked up on the fall schedule to follow Seinfeld.
That's quite a feat, sir.
It was great.
That's quite a feat.
And so that was all good. But then they decided to replace us because the quote was, Warren didn't connect with Jane and me. Like, when was there time to connect? And so years later, this actually made me laugh. I'm skipping a lot of stuff, but it's in the book. I got a phone call from Steve Peterman, who had replaced us. And he said, Billy, would you call me back immediately? It's something I've got to ask you. And I thought, they're going to screw us out of the money. They screwed us out of our develop by credit. Now they're going to screw us out of the money. That's probably what he's calling about. So I call him back. Steve, what is it? Are you making more money off the show than we are? I was like, what? He said, we just got the audit because everybody has to audit everybody because they always rob us. And it was prorated according to how much of the show you owned. And Jane and I were paying substantially more for the audit than Steve and Gary were. And I said, I don't know what you're making off the show. And he said, well, I'll tell you, you know, and he tells me. And he said, are you making more than me? I said, well, yes, I am. And I hear him go, God damn it. And I said, he said, I had to work for 3 full years to get my back in. How long did you have to work? 6 months? I said, 2 weeks. God damn it. There was a little satisfaction in that.
I mean, you had a better agent than he did. That's basically what that means.
Yeah, we had a great agent, but also we were, you know, it was 2 weeks before the upfronts back in New York. They didn't really have a choice.
Right. Yeah. You were in a good position.
Yeah.
And now I want to talk about a pilot that you did for Penny Marshall. And I know Penny a little, and your depiction of her is so great because Penny, more than anybody else that I've ever met, whined and mumbled. I mean, everybody in the Gary Marshall family, they all talk like this, and they all, and when it's like infectious, because when you're around those people, I know Heidi Perlman used to do that, and Sam Simon used to do that, and so I'd be in a writing room at Gracie Films, and they'd be going, I think this joke is really funny. Yeah, I really love this. I think we're in good shape. But add to that, you couldn't even understand Penny.
I couldn't understand her at all. It was so frustrating. We met her for the first time at CBS while we were pitching the pilot. Penny had bought the rights to a show that was very successful in England called Waiting for God. And Olympia Dukakis was hired to play the lead. And Jane and I were hired to write it. So we go to pitch the thing at CBS, and Les Moonves and you know, 400 people are standing there for the pitch. And we're pitching the show, and everybody's doing their laughing thing. And Penny would say something, and the room would be silent, and you'd see people looking at each other like, what did she say? And eventually you would start just laughing, assuming she said something funny. We had no idea what she said, but we'd laugh. And then we got outside, and Olympia, who I can understand very clearly, said, what the hell just happened in there? I said, we just sold the show. She said, we did? All I heard was a lot of people nervous laughing at things that weren't funny. I said, well, that's part of the bit. And she said, just answer me one other thing. What the fuck was Penny Marshall saying? I couldn't understand a goddamn word. And that was Penny Marshall. But I will say she was sharp as a tack in terms of what worked and what didn't work. There was one day we were shooting a scene, and Jane and I were back in the office at that point. We got a phone call to come down to the set. And I walk in, and our director is saying, okay, Michael, I'd like you to enter from over here. And he points to the door on the left. And behind him, I see Penny Marshall waving her hands no and pointing at the other door. So Michael goes to the other door, not where the director told him to stand. And at that point, the director comes over to us and says, I'm quitting. She's been doing this all morning. And I said, well, and Jane immediately, Jane had no problem talking to anybody about anything. Penny, what are you doing? Well, the little guy from Warner Brothers told me to come down here and do this. And so we call up David Gentilari at Warner Brothers and said, what are you doing? He said, well, she's a big director. I thought we'd take advantage of it.
Thanks. Thanks, David.
Yeah. I said, well, Richard Mulligan just threatened to quit. The director threatened to quit. Let's stop doing that. And he said, okay. And so we go back to the set and we realize Penny was right. It was funnier with him coming from the other door, and we moved him over. And the same thing happened to me in the editing room. I would start to edit things the way I liked it. And Penny said, what if we do this? I said, no, we tried that. It didn't work. And I walked out of the room to get another Coke. And I come back in. And the editors moved things around. And suddenly it's done the way she wanted it. And damn if it wasn't better. She was good.
Hmm. And the show didn't get on, as is the case with most pilots that you do, things that you really proud of, and they don't get on. And then you look at what does get on and you just go, what the fuck?
Yeah. There was a season where CBS, I guess, was too much known as the old people's network. So they tried to do very young stuff. And we did a show with David Krumholtz called Staten Island 10309. And it was sort of a high school thing. And it was really good. But it was too young for CBS. It didn't work. So the next year, here we are doing this show that takes place in a nursing home, basically, not an adult community. And somebody, again, accused CBS of being the old people's network. And to prove they weren't, they didn't pick us up.
Yeah.
So yeah. I know. And did you do George and Leo, right?
Yeah, we helped out on George and Leo, which was the one they picked up. But that had the two bigger TV sitcom stars in Bob Newhart and Judd Hirsch. But during that period when CBS said, we're going to young it up, David and I, my partner David Isaacs and I, had an idea basically that starred young people. And our agent said, well, you know, they love you at CBS. You should pitch at CBS. I said, they're never going to do this at CBS. It's way too young for them at CBS. So he said, okay, we'll go to lunch. We'll go to lunch with CBS and just kind of drop it into the conversation and sort of see if they respond to it. So we said, okay, and we went out to lunch with the VP of comedy development, and we slipped it in, and she said, okay, great, we'll do it, we'll buy it. And I'm going, you don't want this show. This is not for you. And they go, no, we're going to be young this time. I said, really, you don't want this show? And they said, no, we do, but yeah, do it. So, okay, we had a sale. We wrote the script. We went through the whole process. At the end of the day, they didn't pick it up because, you know, it's a little bit too young.
Yeah.
So then the next year, we get a call from CBS saying, you know, we had second thoughts about that pilot. So we want to redevelop it a little bit, but basically we want to do the same pilot. So we said, okay. And it was like Charlie Brown and the football. So we did the draft and we went through all the notes and everything else. And at the end of the day, they went, nah, it's just too young for us. Yeah. Okay. Before I let you go, I want to talk a little bit about Jane. And this story has a very unhappy ending in that Jane passed away earlier this year. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, she died in February, and I still haven't been able to grieve because we haven't been able to hold a service yet because of where we are.
Sure.
Jane and I were together 46 years, and I think everybody around her, nobody thought she was going to go. She had a pancreatic cancer, which is horrible, but we kept getting these false hope things of, you take this one pill, and she chemoed until her body just gave out. But it's still surreal to me. I mean, we were not just writing partners. We were just,
you had been through a lot together.
Mm-hmm. We're family. She's my sister. She's whatever. I'm not quite sure how I go on at this point. The nice thing about having a writing partner is always, I don't know who I'm going to blame if somebody doesn't like the jokes. It's always her. But, so this is a very, very hard time for me. This book, I started writing before she got sick, and, she was here through the whole book, and she helped me. She picked the pictures that went in the book, and she corrected a couple of stories. And, so I feel like this is a tribute to her in a way. I did not talk about her death at the end of the book. I didn't think it, funny story. And then she dies. It just didn't feel right.
Right. Sure.
And honestly, until the moment she died, I didn't think she was going. I kept telling her, you can't go. You got to be here to do my funeral. No one else is going to know how to do it. But her family, her four sisters and I we're all family, and we've all been here for each other. And her boyfriend Shelley Jensen, TV director, everybody might know. It's been rough on him, and so I'm not quite sure what's next. I do miss her very, very much.
You working on other projects?
We have. This is weird. She refused to give up at all. We worked up until the time she died. We have three spec pilots that we wrote the entire she was sick, and they're the three best things we've ever done. Uh-huh. So I'm not sure what I'm doing with those. We've had 25 plays floating around the world.
Wow.
Wow. Not now. Right now, all the shows are. But we have 25 plays, one of which is we were touring for about 2 years and we'll continue touring. It's called The Boomer Boys. And so right now, because I've got The Boomer Boys and that's still part of Jane and me, I feel like we're just continuing where we were. and it doesn't feel like I have to make any drastic change yet, you know. It's rough. It's going to be rough, I think.
Well, the book, like I said, is a terrific read. And if you don't even have to want to be a writer. If you're interested at all in just what the TV business is like and what we go through, it's just a terrific example of the life of a writer. And Billy, thank you very much for being here, being my first Zoom interview.
God, I hope you hit record.
I did hit record, but we were 15 minutes late, people, because I didn't know how to start the meeting, and we had to shut down 15 times. So, you know, it's like, yeah, let a couple of boomers try to figure this thing out.
There you go. This was fun. Thank you, man.
Thanks, Billy. Appreciate it.
All right. Take care.
You too. And that will do it for this week on Hollywood and Levine. Our thanks to Billy Van Zandt. And once again, his book is called Get in the Car, Jane. And you can find it at Amazon and wherever books are sold. Are books being sold anywhere these days? Anyway, our thanks as always to Adam and Susie Meister, Butler, Howard Hoffman, John Wolpert, Bruce and Jason Miller. Do you want to get in touch with me? Well, I have an email address, and I will answer you back. Just write me at HollywoodLevine@Outlook.com. Again, that's HollywoodLevine@Outlook.com. You can follow me on Twitter, @KenLevine. Also on Instagram, Hollywood and Levine. Other than that, what can I say? I want a 5-star review. If you find it in your heart, please subscribe to this podcast. Please stay safe, and I will talk to you next week. Thanks so much for listening. Bye-bye.
Hollywood and Levine.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car riding right your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.